Hello everyone, I'm Colin Ellis, and for 30 years I was a permanent employee of other people's cultures. What I wanted to know more than anything else during that time was how to build a great culture myself. And so I wrote a book called Culture Fix, which is the world's first how-to guide for building great workplace culture. And in this, the Culture Makers podcast, I get industry leaders from around the world to expand on the ideas that I wrote about in the book and get them to share actionable things that you can do to create a great place to work yourself. And remember, listening is good, but action is better. Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Culture Makers podcast. Today, I'm delighted to welcome Andy Murray to the show. Andy has almost 40 years experience in project excellence and team building. He started his career as a project manager back in 1991, when it wasn't really a thing, to be perfectly honest with you. I'll ask him about that. And over the last 25 years, he's led some of the most important work in the project management field, from being the lead author for Project Management Methodology Prince 2 2009, to founding Middle East project management communities, to helping local councils around the UK understand what it takes to make projects a success. In July 2020, Andy was appointed as Executive Director of the Major Projects Association based in London, and he joins me today. Hello, Andy.
Hi, Colin. Thanks. That was a bit like, this is your life. I wasn't expecting that intro, so thanks for that.
I was trying to explain that to the kids, this is your life. Oh, it must have been last year, about some guy with a big red book. But obviously, because they don't have the context and they've never seen it, they were like, so just some guy turned up with a book and then invited like their friends. I'm like, oh, these just weren't friends. These were people they hadn't seen for years. And so there's a, but why? And that just wasn't the conversation I wanted to have with him.
Any listeners who don't know what This Is Your Life is, just Google it. You know, that's probably anyone under 45, isn't it?
That's right, yeah. So where did it all start for you, Andy? Home in the UK, obviously. Whereabouts did you grow up? And what did you study? What did you do?
Yeah, so I grew up in Stevenage, which is a post-war new town just outside of London. So it's a really interesting town. I mean, I say it's interesting. I no longer live there, but it was great growing up there. It's quite multicultural in terms of, there was no sort of dominant grouping there, if that makes sense, because everyone, it was a new town, so it didn't have the legacy and the history that I guess some other towns have. And I never realized that growing up. It's really interesting. It's only sort of when I moved away from there and I realized actually how interesting Stevenage was from a new town perspective. It obviously shaped me, but I never realized it. Yes, so that was the early days. Early on, I had an interest in things that I could do easily. I guess that was my overriding development trait as a child. If I could do it quickly and easily and do it once, then I was interested in it. So it's a maths I found interesting. I wasn't necessarily brilliant at it, but I realized that it was the one that had the least homework if you got it right, whereas things like history and geography required a lot more input and a lot more rework, and sort of I shied away from those. Yeah, so things like so Peter Taylor's Lazy Project Manager sort of has really resonated with me. So that's I guess how I got into project work as well. And in terms of, I do like trying new things, and I do like work that's not routine, and that sort of the projects world has ticked that box for me. Always trying something new, doing something new, doing it once,
moving on.
Yes.
Now, I made a bit of a joke at your expense at the start by saying that you were a project manager and wasn't really a thing. Now, obviously, projects have been around for a long time. But the early 90s, as a kind of structured profession, it really wasn't one, was it? So how did that kind of first role come about? Did you go to uni, and was there something where you thought, oh, I like the temporary nature of this? Or was it simply a, let's just get and start working and, you know, see what happens?
Yeah, so I went to university, studied maths, but it was maths for business, so operational research, end of mathematics rather than pure maths. But before I went, I just wrote to all of the local employers and just cheekily said, I'm going to university, would you sponsor me? I got three offers of sponsorship, and one of those was a firm called ICL, International Computers Limited, and my mum happened to work for them previously, not at the time, but she was a switchboard operator for them in the days when when companies had their in-house switchboards and you know, telephonists. So I had a bit of affinity with them as well. And of the companies that offered sponsorship, and it wasn't a great deal of money, but it was enough to make a difference. It was the one that just seemed to be most interesting. So I actually, because of, through the sponsorship, I worked with them over the summer holidays before going to university, and then some holidays between each year. And then I did a 4-year degree with a thick sandwich, so a year out in my third year. When I worked in that year out, I worked on a major project, one of the significant projects that ICL was working on at the time. It was transatlantic telecoms cables that the parent body was responsible for. That was STC. And ICL was delivering the supervisory systems. So it's the diagnostics that would make sure that the lasers in the transatlantic comms cable wouldn't burn out. Because if they burnt out, you had to drag the cable up. And that would take, obviously, while you're dragging it up, you have to find out which laser's gone. So it'll be out of action for quite some time. So you've got all that lost revenue and obviously the cost of dragging a cable up and repairing it. So the supervisory systems were really critical for that bit of infrastructure. So that was, which I worked on for most of that year, actually as a coder doing software development, but involved from the high level design, the system design, then the coding, then the testing, and then bringing into service. So it's really great. I saw the full life cycle of a project through that year, but from a software development perspective. And then when I came back, when I graduated, I heard the news that the bit of code that I worked on had zero bugs. And they wanted to put me into this sort of elite, software development team. And I had to confess that although I enjoyed the full project lifecycle, I didn't actually enjoy software development because I never met a customer. And it was, the interaction I was having with people was quite limited. It was a very small, immediate team, but there was very little interaction outside of that. And sometimes I struggled to understand the purpose of what we were doing because I never had that customer contact. So I sort of gave them the disappointing news. I didn't really want to be a software developer. I haven't been earmarked as this, part of this sort of fast track scheme. And so they put me into bids and projects. And said, okay, if you want the customer interaction, I said, I don't really want to do sales either. So they said, well, actually, it sounds like your project management material. And so that's how I ended up in the project community.
Wow. And was there much structure at the time? Was there much in the way of, I've talked in the past myself about the fact that when I was hired because I was good with people, good with teams, but there was no real blueprint for building teams. Was that the same for you? Was there much in the way of that structure or was it very much a learn as you go?
No. I was very lucky that ICL at the time was a projects-based organization. So outside of its manufacturing base, its client contracts were bid for and won and delivered on a project basis. And the R&D was done on a project basis. So project management permeated the culture of the organization and the structure of the organization. So project management was one of the principal professions that they had. So there was competency frameworks, there was a career path. And the career path was interesting as well because it was separated out in a more functional way. So for example, if you wanted to be in project controls, you could get all the way up to director level as a controls person. Whereas, what I've since found in many other organizations, you move on from controls into other leadership roles. And so it wasn't as recognizing that you can progress, to your strengths in different ways. Yeah, so there was a lot of structure there. We had a project management handbook, for example, and a project management lifecycle, and we had gates. And interestingly, the project gates that then made them their way into Office of Government Commerce, the OGC Gateway Reviews, which I know that you're familiar with, was the work of Sir Peter Gershon, who was at STC and introduced that. STC came into ICL and obviously then adopted by MOD and government and now pretty much universal. The concept of sort of gated life cycles and gateway reviews.
So in terms of kind of building teams then, Andy, what did you learn about yourself? What did you learn about team building? Because obviously for projects are quite different. It's not like you've got a team and then that's it until a member of the team leaves and then you replace them with them. It's very much about the temporary nature of that, bringing people together, which you'll have seen across your career, is how do you bring people together and then kind of inspire and motivate them and then they're gone again, right? It's that whole matrix management.
Yeah, and that's really hard, isn't it? You know, getting the team building or the sense of team in a temporary world. And what I've sort of learned over the years is that different people are predisposed to working in temporary teams in different ways. And you've heard the expression of people going native. You can tell, I think, I think I can tell quite quickly when I put a temporary team together, the ones that are going to go native quickly, those that want to belong to the project more than they want to belong to their host team or their host organization. And then you get the others that only really regard the project team as something that they're doing almost on a voluntary basis. And actually their real work is with their host organization or their permanent team. So I do feel that you've got, you know, two ends of that spectrum of with people that some people that really want to belong and want to belong quite quickly, and others are very tentative and don't really want to throw their hat into that project ring, so to speak. And you've got to work with both. I mean, there's a downside of both of those. There's an upside of both as well. So I've worked on projects where that going native culture gripped the project, and the project quickly gained a sort of siege mentality, which can be good. But that siege mentality then turned to language like us and them. And then the users and the customers and the stakeholders becoming the enemy because they keep changing their minds and they don't know what we're doing. And the project became more important than the outcome they were trying to deliver. So there's some dangers of that, that want to belong to the team, you know, above everything else, as there is those that don't want to join the team and need to be, worked on. So they're the sort of two things I've always observed when you're putting those temporary teams together, the fact that not everyone has the same appetite to want to belong to the team for different reasons.
There's a fine line between cult and culture, right? I think that's kind of what you're talking about. You have that siege mentality where it's all about us and the way that we want to do things, it's a cult, right? And the culture is where we work with the customers, with the stakeholders to make sure that we deliver. And do you think those people can be turned around, or in your experience, how did you turn those people around? Obviously, given your track record, you've managed to do it a few times.
Yeah, well that's so one is about creating that sense of team, and that's not something you do quickly, and that's not something you do on paper. And I think that's a really important aspect. I've also spent a lot of my time as a consultant reviewing projects and organizations, looking at their project management capability. And I'll often see, you know, when we're going through looking at, you know, teaming aspects, and a project manager would present me a project management plan with a comms plan within it and some values that they've written down, and say, look, that's the culture of the team. And then you go and interview a few people, talk to people on the project, and you know, they're not even aware of it. When I say, tell me, you know, three things that would describe, you know, how this project is operating, they wouldn't use the words that are in that document. So it has to be beyond what's on paper, and that's about getting to know people. Getting people to know each other. It's about those shared experiences that people need to go through, which take time. And that's sometimes you don't have the luxury of time on a temporary project if you're doing it at pace. But then it's also about having that common sense of purpose. And I would always start with that common sense of purpose first, because that's something you can work on quite quickly and get everyone to agree what is it we're trying to achieve. And so when, you know, the team either goes to either end of that spectrum of people not wanting to commit or people overcommitting and in danger of going native or into that siege mentality, you can bring them back to that purpose.
And that's that foundation then for the culture of the team, just that reminder of we're all in this together. This is what we're working on. We met probably, I think it was 2009 in New Zealand? I think it was 2009, 10, something like that.
Yes.
And you know, we at the time, the New Zealand government was very determined to implement something that they saw as standard. You know, for me at the time as an executive in government, I was kind of saying, yeah, this is cool. We need some of this. I've been obviously worked in the private sector in the UK, so we had that approach, but we can't afford to lose sight of the fact that projects are delivered by people. Those people are more effective when they work together, just, you know, across human history. So we need to marry the two. Is that something that you saw, particularly as you moved from a project manager into consulting with all of the organizations that you've worked for, all of the reviews that you've done? Do you still see that sometimes that over-reliance on process and method as opposed to trying to find that balance with the team building and the culture side of things as well, Andy?
Definitely so. And particularly in environments where there might be a lot of scrutiny, where there's independent assurance and, that assurance may be shared publicly. It's very easy for leaders, project leaders, to focus on the tangible aspects that you can show, which is by nature the process elements, to say that, we've achieved those aspects. But as you know, and as we've discussed many times, it's the people aspects that are critically important and need to operate as well as those process aspects. And the people bits can get lost when you've got a review coming up, or you've got a gate coming up, or you've got something that's going out to the public or to your stakeholders. It's easy to focus on those tangible items, the things you can show and demonstrate. It's difficult to demonstrate a sense of team. You can't. How can you present it? It will exhibit its way in different ways, won't it? But you can't. If you had an auditor turning up, you couldn't say, "Here's my sense of team." They would have to experience it themselves. And again, this is if there's sort of panel auditors or people from an assurance community listening in, I really favour assurance through observation. So sitting in on project board meetings, sitting in on project team meetings, listening in to conference calls, you get an understanding then about the dynamics between the teams when you do so. And people quite quickly forget that you're listening in and you're sitting in and observing those. There's a bit of, play acting or, playing to the gallery, as they say, early on. But after a while, that they forget. And you can start to see what's really going on, on projects. I'll give you a way of an example. And this is a sort of a leadership cultural aspect. I sat as an independent advisor on a portfolio board whilst it was establishing itself. So it was, over a year, say. It was a little short of a year, but it was in the sort of the first few meetings that they had whilst they're getting the terms of reference and the practice going. There was a program board below it. So there was one at the time, there was one dominant program, and then there were obviously projects below that. In time, there would be some other programs that would be initiated too. But the difference between the program and the project layer and the portfolio one was that their horizon planning was meant to be 3 to 5 years. So beyond the sort of the current business plan timeframe, so that they could start to set up things they needed to do for the next period of time whilst they were delivering the current plan, if that makes sense. First two meetings, they were discussing stakeholder launch events in the next 3 months. The furthest date I ever heard in those first few meetings was about 4 or 5 months out. I never heard anything in the 3 to 5 year period. Now, that's just a common sense of purpose gain, isn't it, within that group, which is we know these things are interesting and important, but we actually have to have that self-awareness that we're talking about things that are in the near term, and then that self-control collectively to say, let's stop. And let's agree amongst us that if any of us are talking about things in the next few months, yellow card, stop, move on, and let's start thinking about things we might need to do in the next few months, but for the benefit of the long-term plan. And they got there, but that was something where they just had to come to a collective agreement to think about how they were going to work together and that sort of safe way of working where they could call each other out and say, stop talking about that, or that's not for this meeting.
Yeah, and that safety is crucially important, right? And organizations are striving for this kind of inclusive way of doing things. My first question is it safe to do so? Do people feel that they'll have the finger of blame pointed at them? Do they feel trusted? Are they empowered to make decisions? And again, that's something you'll have seen across your career. Often those play out in meetings or those little interactions where that safety is compromised and people clam up, Andy, right? And all of a sudden, that fear undermines the culture, and consequently things don't get aired in the way that they should, such that the issues can be resolved.
Yeah, it's really important to set those sort of it's the ground rules, but then reinforcing them. And again, that's sort of the other thing that I've learned is that as I started off in this conversation, that I like doing things once, but repetition is important in terms of reinforcing culture or behaviors you want on a project. So as the work I did on Prince 2, leading that team, we had a really diverse team of authors on that, deliberately so. So we had people at the very hard end of project management, the structure and the process, and it had to be right. And we had you know, some contributors, you know, at the soft end, and it's all about the people. And we had to bring those two views together. But we also had differences between people that were more about leadership and others more about control. So, and others were more about planning, and one was more about, well, it's being adaptive. So we had the different perspectives. But the one thing that we had in common was, you know, and there was a couple of things I kept on going, which is, you know, this version of Prince 2 is going to be at most two-thirds in terms of page count or word count as the previous versions, because, you know, we want, you know, a thinner guide is better in my view.
Yeah.
And if I could have halved it, that would have been even better. But, you know, less guidance is more in terms of being impactful. And the other one was, it was in plain English. So we had, you know, apart from Prince 2, which is an abbreviation, an acronym, there were no abbreviations, no acronyms in the guide, and we drilled that through. And we even, you know, got plain English guides. We took some journalistic guides. So in terms of how do journalists write, you know, short sentences, you know, there was a lot of work we put in around the authoring aspect, and everyone knew that when we were producing things, that was the first thought, which is it simple? Can everyone pick it up? Is it, you know, will it engage with people outside of a technical community? And that was our goal. But that was something we had to reinforce. You know, every meeting, every call we had, you know, plain English was the first thing I kept on reminding people. Keep it simple, keep it plain.
That's right, because when you keep it simple, that's when people understand. And when people understand, they feel connected and engaged with it. And consequently, it removes a crucial barrier to change and to progress. Now, you spent over 20 years as a consultant, probably close to 30 years. And recently, you're back into a permanent role as executive director of the Major Projects Association. Tell us a little bit about that, because you're back into team building with your own little team. And obviously, you've got some goals that you're working on as well.
Yeah, so the Major Projects Association is a membership body. It's got about 100 members, and the sort of the unique element of the association is the focus on major projects, and that the membership comes from all of the types of organizations that need to work together and collaborate to deliver major projects successfully. So that's policymakers, it's the government departments that sponsor major projects like transport, energy, and so on. It's the industry entities that, you know, construction, engineering, technology firms that deliver those large parts of those projects. Advisors, finance in terms of investors, you know, that would fund projects. Regulators and assurers, academics, you know, so it's the full 360, if you like, of bodies or organizations or entities that need to work together to deliver major projects. But also it's multidiscipline as well, multi-profession, if you like. So project management is only one part. So engineering, commercial management, procurement, law, finance, you know, economics, all these professions are important to the specifying, initiation, delivery of major projects. So that's the association. So it's quite an eclectic mix of members. And even within those member organizations, it's quite an eclectic mix of professions and disciplines. So it's really interesting from that perspective. And the goal of the association is around the sharing of experience and knowledge to improve the initiation, delivery of major projects. So we don't hold a body of knowledge, for example. So we just facilitate the bringing of parties together and the sharing of those experiences and knowledge. So the as a membership organization, we want to make sure that as much of the membership fee goes to membership benefits. So it's quite a small team I actually oversee. So that's interesting in terms of, you know, in a small team, there's no hiding places, as you know. So every member of the team has to perform. And if you have one non-performing team member, it's difficult for everyone. So that is a different dynamic when you've got small teams. I've inherited a good team. So that's, you know, if you like, my first challenge, but my need to be very mindful of, you know, I'm not coming into an underperforming or a poor performing team. This is a good, you know, a well-performing team. And so I have to nurture and enhance that rather than say, right, here's some radical changes we're going to do. You know, there's nothing for me to turn around in that respect. So that's great. But it is a different way of coming in and working with people when there isn't a fix that's needed. And I guess that would be be our natural instinct as project professionals is that we want to come in and change something, don't we? That's our reason for being. So there's that aspect. But the other aspect of it is that although we've got a small team, a lot of what the association does is through the members. So when we put events on, often it will be someone from one of the member organizations that will act as technical advisor for that event, who will help to put together what the topic will be, what the theme will be. We'll work with our program committee to identify potential speakers and contributors. We'll have a chair that will typically come from the membership, and the speakers and the contributors will also come from membership. So we have a lot of volunteers. And so if you like, every event that we put on is a mini project, if you like, and going back to some of my earlier roots of bringing volunteers together to work on those. And projects with volunteers is always a challenge in terms of coming back to that, people from that don't want to commit to those people that overcommit. When people are volunteers, that's an added layer of insight that you need to understand what the motivations are for those individuals to get involved and what's their ability to contribute. So beyond events, we also have some working groups where we look at different topics that are critical to major projects. So for the last 5 years, the association has taken a leadership position around equality, diversity and inclusion, and has done a lot of work with its members around things like unconscious bias and looking at gender balance and so on. And that work continues, but that's sort of an ongoing portfolio of initiatives now, where we've got people working either through studies or through engagement activities on that as a topic, to how we can improve that within the world of major projects, but also how major projects benefits from a more inclusive and diverse workforce and contributors to the projects. And other aspects around sustainability is one of our other strategic initiatives at the moment. So how major projects work to contribute to things like net zero. And that's all about the project purpose, about things like the circular economy. So when you're thinking about a new project, how can you think of it in terms of reusing existing resources, or can you link a new scheme with a decommissioning scheme that's going on? But also in the project itself, how can you minimize the resources and energy consumption that it needs to produce the outcome? So some interesting work that the association has, but the leadership challenge is we could do so much. So how do we make sure that we keep that focus and make sure that we don't end up doing 90% of lots of things and achieving nothing, rather than doing 100% of a much shorter list and making an outcome or an impact.
Fascinating, Andy. Thank you so much for joining us. I mean this quite sincerely, having followed your work for a while. They couldn't have had a better person to lead that work. I want to say a big thank you for joining us on the Culture Maker podcast and for sharing your thoughts with us. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Colin. It's been very enjoyable. I've really enjoyed this chat as I have in our chats when we've not been recorded. So.
Long may they continue. Thanks so much, Andy. Thanks so much for listening to today's podcast. Please remember to subscribe or share the link on your social media platform of choice, LinkedIn, Facebook, Twitter, wherever you hang out. You can also forward it onto your colleagues and friends and help them to inspire and motivate others too. Better still, why not keep the conversation going and join our community of culture makers from around the world who share information on the things that have worked and haven't worked? You can do that at www.culturefixcommunity.com. And remember, sharing is caring. See you next time.